With us as soon as we get him back. Tonight we've got an interesting show as always. We've got my good friend Dusty Smith with us tonight. She's been in paranormal research for quite some time. She's been around the block, so to speak, in the paranormal world. She is the founder of Daytona Beach Paranormal Research Group, Daytona Beach, Florida, authored several books. She's had a lot of interesting experiences. We're going to talk about those tonight. She holds certifications in paranormal research as well as several degrees in fields such as biology, psychology, history, and theology that helps her in the paranormal field. And interestingly, too, she is the author of the book Dread and the Dead Filled the Dunham House, which was also used for an episode of A Haunting, specifically A Haunting in Florida for the Discovery Channel series A Haunting. And we're very honored to have Dusty with us tonight. Dusty, thanks for being with us.
Not a problem, Doug. You know I love you.
Well, I appreciate
the intro, by the way.
Oh, you like that?
Yeah. I like the music, not me.
Oh, yeah, the voice and all that. Yeah, you know, it's showbiz.
I know.
I can go a little ways for the showbiz thing and all that. So, Dusty, you and I met 2 years ago or so in Crystal River. We were both doing a little conference they were having there. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it was very interesting. I don't know what happened, but it's like we met and we connected.
Yep, we definitely clicked.
Yeah, so what's up with that stuff?
Well, I think that's called, like, you know, having a brain, being intelligent, you know, and you kind of recognize that in other people, and that's a good thing, you know. The conference in Crystal River was definitely... An interesting one. You know, I've lectured at many, many, many different conferences, you know, and all of them stand out in my mind for one reason or another. Usually it's because they're very enjoyable or, you know, because of the wonderful people that I get to meet and network with and, you know, all of that good stuff. But that particular one was, you know, it wasn't the people that I met, because, you know, I did get to meet you and several other folks, but the conference was just very poorly put together, and, you know, I think, seriously, if it wasn't for you and I carrying the lecturing end of it, you know, and then finding out that the investigation that was scheduled in the cemetery, that they didn't even have permission to be in the cemetery that night, that was just another, you know, nail in the coffin of the guy who put it on. And, you know, I don't play those games, so.
Yeah, I didn't stay for the cemetery thing. I just needed to get home. It was a bit of a jaunt. Of course, you had a bit of a drive, too. But speaking of cemetery stuff, one of the things I did not mention in your bio, which is in there, it's just so long. You have so much in your bio. I could have spent an hour reading it. One of the things you do, and I know Grant is going to talk about this once I get him connected again, but is your work with cemetery preservation. Now, you basically manage at several cemeteries. You want to talk about that a little bit, about your work?
Yeah, actually I do. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
We started the International Association of Cemetery Preservationists almost 5 years ago now. And the reasoning behind it was, you know, there's literally tens of thousands of these abandoned and neglected cemeteries all over the United States and, of course, the world. And it just, you know, I've been one of those people all my life that fights for the underdog. You know, I remember when I was a kid picketing Long Island Lighting Company because they were dumping their effluent into the Long Island Sound and it was causing fish kills. You know, so I've always had a cause, you know, whether it was manatees or sea turtles or whales or dolphins or whatever. I mean, you know, I have five dogs and every one of them was, you know, a rescue. But cemeteries to me are the biggest underdog there is. They basically have no voice. You know, the laws that govern them are very inadequate. The funding is even less adequate, you know, and people don't want to talk about cemeteries. And, you know, one of the reasons is because it makes them face their own mortality.
Yeah.
And basically what the IACP does is we go in and we take over these cemeteries and we fix them up. We repair and clean up the headstones. We, you know, take care of the fallen trees and trim up the bushes and, you know, all of that good stuff and secure the area with fencing and lighting and, you know, do whatever we can to make the cemetery a decent place, not just for folks to visit, but for the, you know, the folks that are laid to rest there. And one of the requirements of being a member of the Daytona Beach Paranormal Research Group is that each member has to donate an afternoon a month doing cemetery preservation work. And, you know, I'm pretty lenient as far as certain rules of mine go, you know, about showing up for business meetings and, you know, things like that, because believe me, I know they're boring, you know, but when it comes to the cemeteries, I'm pretty strict about it. And, you know, if you miss three cemetery cleanups a year, you're gone, you know, because it's great to go out and do investigations and have fun doing that, but, you know, you got to give back to the community. And, you know, a lot of people think that it's kind of my strong-armed way of blackmailing people into free work, and, you know, maybe it is. I don't know, but... You know, we've got one cemetery that we've completely finished, another one that's about two-thirds of the way done, and several more on the list that, you know, we'll slowly but surely get them, get to them and get them done. And, you know, it's one of my things that I take a lot of pride in as far as the amount of work that my researchers do put into the cemeteries. You know, and it's funny, the one that we completed last year, I have people call me now wanting to know how much it is to get a burial plot in there. And it's like, no, cemetery's been closed since 1984. Sorry, you know, but.
So you take care of how many in Daytona Beach? How many cemeteries?
In the Daytona Beach area, we have five that we do volunteer work at. And there's, through the different branches of the IACP, we have 38 cemeteries altogether presently. And that's only after, you know, 4 years and a couple of months of the organization becoming official. And we are a 501c3, so if anybody wants to donate any funds, you know, drop me an email.
Yeah, that's really great. Now, the one that you do the ghost tours on is... Which one again?
That's Pinewood Cemetery.
Right.
Pinewood Cemetery is not one of our adopted cemeteries, but we do still do some volunteer work there. It's owned by a private philanthropist who, you know, I don't want to say this so that it makes him sound bad, but he donates about $250,000 a year to the cemetery for preservation and restoration, and I'm sure he uses it as a tax write-off. because he is a very wealthy doctor here in town.
Well,
you know, but his heart's in the right place doing it that way, you know. And it is very well taken care of as far as restoration goes.
Well, that's good. Mm-hmm. And then you take care of the Mount Ararat. That's in Daytona.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And that one, of course, is a new one of the more recent ones that you picked
up. Yeah, we acquired Mount Ararat in 2004. April of 2004, as a matter of fact. And when I first walked through that cemetery, I was almost in tears with the amount of damage. I mean, I've seen a lot of terrible things in cemeteries, but this one just went so far beyond. And the stories, you know, when we're out there doing work, we run into a lot of family members that come out and visit and whatever, and you know, the stories that they've told me about things that have gone on out there are just heartbreaking. And when we first took it over, my main reason, I mean, besides I knew the cemetery needed help, was we had come across a vault that's a concrete, regular, plain old vault that someone had taken a granite headstone from one woman and used it to break out the corner of this concrete vault, and they stole the woman's skull that was in the vault.
Wow.
You know, and people ask me all the time, you know, why do people do that stuff? You know, if to me, that's the million-dollar question. If I could answer that question, I would be a very wealthy woman.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, we catch, you know, it's kind of understandable when we catch teenagers trespassing on the weekends, you know. You get a carload of kids with a, you know, stolen six-pack of dad's beer and, you know, whatever they're doing, and they want to scare their girlfriends or, you know, whatever. You know, I get it, you know. But when we catch, you know, 45-year-olds in there, you know, having sex in the back of the pickup truck, I don't get it. You know, it's like you can't afford a $20 a night motel. You know, it just, to me, it's disrespectful, and it's not going to happen in my cemeteries. And slow but sure, over the course of time, not only does do the members of the community and the high schools and universities know to take me seriously, but the local police departments do now, too. You know, it used to be years ago, I would call and say, you know, we've got trespassers in the cemeteries, and they basically go, so, you know, I'd be like, whoa, wait, you know, Florida state law, section 512, blah, 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 blah. And I'd go through this on the phone with the 911 operator, and it's like, wait a minute, it's not your job to question me. It's your job to send an officer, you know, bottom line.
Really?
And then you got to go through the same spiel when the officer arrives because they don't know the law, you know. And now that we've educated them, and they realize, hey, this is a pretty easy arrest, you know, they follow through with it, and it works out good all the way around, except for the person who's vandalizing or trespassing in my cemeteries.
Well, let me ask you this. For those groups out there who might have a cemetery in their neck of the woods that needs some help, how can they get involved with that?
Well, you know, the first thing you have to do is you have to find out who owns the cemetery, and sometimes that's kind of a hard thing to do. A lot of abandoned and neglected cemeteries are still privately owned, but most of the time a municipality has picked them up, either a city or a county or whatever. And that's one of the reasons they stay neglected is because there's just no funding for them. Once you find out who the specific owner is, just contact them and say, look, you know, we want to go in and help clean this place up and make it look better. And, you know, we're not up to any monkey business. And then your next step is make it a trespass arrest site, which is very easy to do. You can just go to the local police station, and they have a standardized form you fill out. And then you have to put no trespassing signs up every 100 feet or 100 yards. Along the perimeter, and the address has to be clearly marked. That way, you know, if anybody's in there after posted closing hours, they can be arrested for trespassing, and then you just go from there, just start cleaning it up.
Okay, so let me a couple questions in the chat room. You're not actually purchasing the cemeteries, are you?
We own two of them.
Oh, okay, so you have purchased a couple.
Well, we didn't want to. Don't get me wrong, I love my cemeteries, but cemeteries are very expensive, especially when you're not selling plots. Even when you are selling plots, they're very expensive. And the reason I say that is because a lot of these older cemeteries, when their bylaws were written up, you know, the one, Mount Ararat, comes to mind, the burial plots out there sell for $100 a piece. Well, that's great for people who can't afford to get buried next door in the nice manicured cemetery for $6,000, you know, but at the same time, you're not bringing any money into the cemetery. By the time you dig the grave and pay the guy with the heavy equipment to do so and put everything back where it's supposed to be, you know, it's already cost you money because he charges you $250.
Uh-huh.
You know, Saints and Sinners Cemetery is a gigantic red tape nightmare that's owned technically by the city of Oak Hill, but because they buried the bodies in the wrong section, it's actually owned by a conglomerate of lawyers in South Florida, and they sold it to us for a dollar.
Huh.
They said, "Oh, we don't want it. We can't develop it because it's too costly to move the cemetery. So here, take it. It's yours." You know.
That's amazing. Huh. Okay, so if groups want to give back to the community on that, I know that your organization, your association can help them. You want to give the website that they can get
money?
Sure.
We're fixing to move it, and they're going to be very simple. It's IACPINC.org.
Okay, and I believe we've got that up on the website. And what I'm going to do, Dusty, the International Association of Cemetery Preservationists is on paranexusradio.org. If you look under Dusty's bio and all that stuff there, I have the
because right now our homepage is still on AOL Hometown. I'm trying to get all the updates done before a really good friend of mine moves my site for me.
Who would that be? Gee.
I don't know.
I do have the AOL, though, and what I'll do is hook up a redirect on your primary domain.
Right. Okay, cool.
At least for short term. Okay, so let me ask you this. There's another question here. Are most cemeteries on private property, or are they municipalities?
Well, either way, it's the same thing. Even if a municipality owns a cemetery, it's still considered private property. Florida laws are pretty straightforward about cemeteries. It's just nobody seems to know them. And, you know, one of the things that I try to explain to paranormal investigators and ghost hunters is that, you know, these are not private investigation sites. This is like going to somebody's home. You know,
mm-hmm.
you still have to get permission to be there, and you still have to be very respectful when you're there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can't be sitting on headstones or, you know, leaving
mm-hmm.
cigarette butts all over the ground. I mean, you wouldn't put a cigarette butt out on somebody's carpet, would you?
Yeah.
I mean, this is the same thing, and that's how you have to view it. And because some of these older cemeteries are dangerous places to be in, you know, a lot of places will give you permission to go into the cemeteries, especially if it's owned by a municipality, you know, but it's just safer all the way around if you get permission to be there. Don't go jumping over fences or, you know, scooching through gates or whatever. Excuse me. And, you know, what you need to do is survey the place during the daylight hours. I can't tell you how many times, you know, we've caught folks in Mount Ararat stuck in a vault, busted, you know, and it's like, you know, how do you get out once you're in and now you've sprained your ankle, you know, duh, because they don't know where they're going. And you you experienced the demonic attack cactus of Mount Ararat. You know, you never know what the natural flora and fauna is going to be out there. I mean, you know, we've got red-tailed foxes, we've got pygmy rattlesnakes, we've got the demonic attack cactus, you know, and you go wandering around out there at night, you know, whether you've got a flashlight or not, and you stumble across something that's not happy you're there. And I'm not talking just about the living stuff. I mean, we've had a couple of incidents out there with spirits that are not happy with people, and they let them know it too. So, you know, it's...
Well, cool. Well, we got... We're able to get Grant back. Grant.
Hi, Grant.
I know he's
we
back.
We need more to get Doug. You know, this always happens every time I mess around with it. But, Dusty, it's so good to have you here. I'm sorry I was cast out into ether because of our connection. So.
Oh,
it's
that's
good to
okay.
Be here.
We're glad you're back. Just don't touch
and
any
I'm
more
glad
buttons.
To be here.
We've been talking about the cemetery, waiting for you to come back. And I know that you had mentioned to me, Grant, that that's one thing you really appreciated about Dusty, her work with the cemetery. So if you want to comment on that, then we're going to move on to
it. Oh, yeah. Well, I would certainly encourage anybody in our audience, if you're going over to Daytona Beach at any time in the near future, go on Dusty's Ghost Tour, because Dusty is a wonderful speaker. She knows her history and has a fascinating tour. But one of the things that I just really admire about Dusty and her group is the fact that they do cemetery restoration. And I think that she not only provides a service to the community in a sense of doing the historical ghost tour, but I mean a real service by going out there and busting and cleaning up those cemeteries. So, you know, that's an example for all of us to provide to our communities as these groups. So, Dusty, my hat's off to you.
Thank you, Grant. Where do I send the check?
All right, let's switch gears. Go ahead, Grant, if you're going to follow up.
Oh no, I was done. You just do one. Work, Dusty. Really appreciate it. Everybody does.
Since you mentioned the ghost tour, what I'd yeah. like to add to the tail end of that is that you know, I don't take a paycheck for doing the tours. We operate 7 nights a week, pretty much all year long. We don't go, of course, during Bike Week and Biketoberfest because there's no way to speak above you know, all the Harleys that are in town. Mm-hmm. And there's a couple of major holidays we're closed. But all of the proceeds from the tours benefits our cemeteries as well. So, you know, not only are people learning about the specific history and hauntings that are documented, our stories are real. This is not folklore, folks. You know, they also know that their money is going to a good cause. It's not going in my pocket.
No, that's good. And we took your ghost tour at the, what is it again, Pinewood. Pinewood, yeah, Pinewood. In fact, I took a pretty cool picture. I think it's cool. I mean, it doesn't have any paranormal stuff in it, but it's a cool picture of that, and we're going to put it on the front cover of the Journal of Paranormal Research next issue. And
cool.
It's I don't know, it turned out nice. I just liked it. Anyway, let's move along a little bit. We're going to be coming up to a break here shortly. And I want to talk about some things when we come back from the break. I want to talk a little bit about, and I don't want to rehash like you've probably done a zillion times about how you got started, but I'd like to really focus on what things have you picked up along the way. I'd like to talk about you have a new book out. What's the name of that one again?
Actually, it's not out yet.
Oh, it's not quite out yet.
Yeah, the deadline's May 31st. It'll be out for the fall Halloween season, but it's about... haunted locations in DeLand, Casadega, and one of Florida's only ghost towns, St. Francis.
Cool. So that'll be out. When do you think that might be available?
Probably September of this year.
Okay. But your other book we'll talk about, The Dread and Dead.
The other two books are out, yeah, and we'll talk about that.
Mm-hmm. We'll talk about those. We'll talk about some of your experience with extreme hauntings, and so... For our listeners out there, if you do paranormal research, you're going to pick up some things. You really are. And I'm going to take just a moment before our break to encourage folks to go take a look at paranexus.org. It's a new professional association of paranormal researchers that my good friend and colleague Yari Mikula out of Denver and I have started. We've got really high hopes for this thing, folks. We're going to not only have a database, but this is a top-notcher. This is the real thing. This is something that is for serious, serious paranormal researchers. It's not for the ghost hunter group, quote-unquote. And, Dusty, we've talked about that. You've talked about that. We've all talked about that. There's a difference between ghost hunters and paranormal researchers.
Exactly.
And so this is for the paranormal researchers, parapsychologists, cryptozoologists, and ufologists. And it's just going to be a database as well as a place to connect and share data. And, of course, we've got the conference coming up in Tampa this October, a week before Halloween. We've got some great speakers, one of which is Dusty. And the thing that I think is so cool is that Dusty's going to be a featured guest on Saturday morning. She's going to play that episode of A Haunting in Florida. Maybe some of you have seen it on the Discovery Channel. I've seen it several times. I saw it the first night it came out. That was so cool. I said, hey, I know her. Anyway, she's going to be showing that. And then afterwards, she's going to be discussing some things that weren't in it. She's going to be filling in the blanks and discussing some stuff about extreme haunting. So go visit paranexus.org. Right now, you can join Paranexus as a charter member for $5 for 6 months. There's member pricing for the conference and for some other resources on there. The Paranormal Investigator Certification course, I just updated a little bit. It's the third edition. We are now offering it in two fashions. One, full certification. You get the certificate, the IDs, and that sort of thing. But you can also just get the course without the certification, a little less expensive, and get the knowledge. And so if you're starting out or if you've been doing paranormal research, I know that course is going to get you thinking. I know it's going to shed some new light on some different things. And that's what it's for. It's to get you thinking. So some things there. We'll be talking more about that. If you will just hang tough with us, listeners, we'll be back in just a moment. Hi, this is Doug Kelly, founder of the Spirit Team. We perform professional paranormal research and investigations at no charge to you. If you are experiencing mysterious events in your home or business, please contact us. We maintain your privacy and we won't think you're crazy. And if you're a paranormal researcher, we offer an accredited certification course that will enhance your knowledge of the paranormal field and raise credibility with your clients. For more information, please visit our website at spiritteam.org. That's Spirit Team with one T.org.
Is there a suppression of UFO and alien information by our government?
Does the soul continue on after we die?
Climb aboard the black ship of Paranormal Radio with your host, Captain Jack, on Contact Talk Radio and KRWM 106.9 FM HD3. Or visit WPRTRadio.com for more information.
Thank you. night, in the shadows, in the sky, it's Paranexus Universe. Darkness follows.
Welcome back, everybody. This is Doug Kelly, along with my co-host and friend, Grant Rubendunst. Welcome back, Grant.
Hey, welcome, everybody, and happy Friday night.
Yeah, and we're talking with our good friend and special guest, Dusty Smith. Welcome back, Dusty.
Thank you, Doug. Thank you, Grant.
We've been talking about cemetery preservation, some tips on giving back to the community and so forth. Now let's take this in the direction of your experience with paranormal research, Dusty. Briefly, what led you to it?
Actually, it's kind of a funny story. I got into this field totally by accident. I mean, it's always been something, you know, like most people, that intrigues me, you know, but I never thought about actually doing this to help people. And I had a kind of routine I used to do every year. On my birthday, I'd make plans to go and have dinner and take a ghost tour up in St. Augustine. And it just so happened I bought a new camera for myself that year for my birthday. And when we went over to Huguenot Cemetery, I took a couple of photos. And when the kid at Walgreens developed them and handed them to me, I'm going through them as he's, you know, changing my money out. And I almost, you know, killed this poor kid. I'm like, what'd you do with my film? What the hell is this? You know? And he was like, lady, it's not me. It's on the negative. Look, you know, and I went, okay, you just saved your own life, you know. But I wound up getting a full body apparition of the very famous haunting of Judge Stickney, which, you know, that was it. I was hooked. You know, it was, we started spending every spare moment we could up there. I got a couple of friends together, you know, and we became, you know, weekend ghost hunters and got in touch with some of the ghost tour owners up there and started documenting some of their cases for them or some of their stories. They actually got us into Huguenot Cemetery at night. And as far as I know, we're still the only research group that's been allowed in there at night, which also produced photos of two full body apparitions. What else? And then it kind of snowballed from there. You know, we formed the research group, and then from that, because, you know, we needed funds to help buy some equipment, we started researching the cemetery here, and the caretaker at the time, Howard Wetherill, was kind enough to let us in at night, and we documented the stories, found out that, you know, these folk tales that everybody thought were just stories turned out that a good percentage of them were actually real hauntings. And then so we started the ghost tour and started funneling money into the research group for equipment. And then once the research group was, you know, established and we had everything we needed, that's when I sat back and I just was not comfortable taking the money from the tours. I felt, you know, like it was like I was using the spirits or something. And that's when we formed the cemetery group officially. We had been doing preservation work way before that and just started funneling the money into the cemetery preservation group.
So that started about the same time you started doing research.
Same actual time. Yeah, we started doing, we had been doing research for about 8 months prior to starting cemetery preservation officially, but I've been doing cemetery work for, you know, closer to two decades, way before I started the research group. And just in case, you know, there's a couple of people out there that don't know, you know, there is a difference between being a ghost hunter and a paranormal investigator. Ghost hunters hunt ghosts in known haunted locations, and paranormal investigators investigate areas of purported paranormal activity. And a lot of people don't understand that that is a difference, you know. And some people think that paranormal investigators look down on ghost hunters, and that's not the truth. I mean, it's two totally separate things. You know, a paranormal investigator can also be a ghost hunter and vice versa. You know, it just depends on what you want to do and how you want to do it. And I can I get on my soapbox? Of course.
Sure.
Well, you look at me.
Okay, I'll pipe. Go ahead.
My problem with this these days is, you know, with the resurgence in the field and, you know, the 20 million groups that are cropping up all over the place, I don't have a problem with there being 20 million new groups. It's the ones that are not doing the job responsibly, that are charging the clients, that, you know, profess client confidentiality and show up in a, you know, neon green van that says Ghostbusters on the side with sirens blaring and all kinds of stuff. Yeah, that's keep that confidential, you know.
Yeah.
You know, just because you've got a digital camera and, you know, a laser-sighted thermometer doesn't make you a ghost hunter or a paranormal investigator.
Right.
You know, you've got to study, you've got to take the courses that are out there, you've got to read the material and, you know, get involved with the people that have been in the field, you know, for decades. I mean, Christ, I still call Troy Taylor or Dave Giuliano or, you know, Jason Hawes when I'm up against something. I mean, I've been doing this 13 years and I still look to them for advice. I mean, you know. And there's so many new groups now that think, you know, oh, I read this book and I watched, you know, one season of Ghost Hunters. I know what I'm doing. No, you don't.
Okay. There's a lot of stuff to learn. You know, that's why I wrote the course in the first place, is there's so many things to know so that you can kind of get pointed in the right direction. And then you augment that. I mean, everybody who takes the course, or any course for that matter, will augment it with their own experiences, their own thinking, and that's what I promote. Think for yourself, folks.
Exactly.
You know, don't just take somebody's word for it.
Your course was, you know, here I am thinking, you know, I'm kind of at the end of my road. Now I can start mentoring, which I have been, you know, other groups, you know, being in this over a decade now, you know, and I've been writing books and doing lecturing and la, 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 you know. And, you know, I've taken all the courses. I mean, I've got 3 PhDs, for Christ's sake. And then all of a sudden you throw your course at me, and I'm sitting there like a 2-year-old going, eh? You know, I mean, the first question coming out of the gate, why are you in this field? And what do you think you can, you know, give back to the field? I mean, I literally had to stop and think about that. And I know why I'm in it. I'm in it to help people, you know, and I know what I give back. I'm compassionate, I'm empathetic, you know, plus the cemeteries and, you know, being here for clients and all that good stuff, you know, but yeah, it really did. When I first read that question, I went, whoa, okay, you know, and I realized at that point, okay, stupid, you're not done learning in this field, you know.
Yeah, we're
and
never done learning.
That, Doug. Well, I never thought I'd be done learning. I just thought, you know, I mean,
it's an easy question to miss. You know, we do this, and we in our mind we may feel like we know what we're doing, but have we ever thought it through?
Exactly. You know, and it's like, I mean, I've got this hugely extensive library, and like I just told you, I've been boycotting the cable company, so I don't have television.
Until now.
Yeah, until today. Yay. You know, but I consider myself to be a very educated person, and I continue to educate myself in any area that interests me. But when your course came along, I mean, especially after taking that one who shall remain nameless, big fat guy out of Illinois.
Do you have an address?
<That's good. laughs> I mean, Troy Taylor's course through the American Ghost Society is awesome. The one through Flamel College is awesome. The one through the with fat doctor you know who is crap. Don't anybody ever pay for that. If you want to know who he is, email me privately. You know, but your course just kind of blew them out of the water, the two that were the only good ones that were available.
Now I got to send you a check, don't I?
Huh?
Now I have to send you a check, don't I?
Yes, you do.
Put it right.
Hey guys, if I can just jump in here for a second.
No.
You know, one of the things one of the things so I think that Dusty hit on that is so true and that differentiates our group and Dusty's group from a number of other ones is the fact that we really try to embrace an ethical approach in how we deal with our clients. That's more in line with the helping professions in a sense that, you know, we do no harm. And I'm what Dusty kind of alluded to, we've come across groups that have gone out to home sites and actually scared people with some of their tactics. And, you know, I couldn't agree with you any more, Dusty. I, Doug and I have been talking about, you know, the creation of a paranormal review board or something here in the state because,
You
know, we really need to police our own groups.
Exactly. And, you know, Grant, it's so funny that you mentioned that because one of the things on one of the American Ghost Society's discussion boards has been going on is how do you get, you know, all of these people together in this community and get them to agree on a set of standards and protocol calls, and then how do you enforce it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, because, I mean, there's already dissension in the ranks. You've got groups out there that, you know, bicker and fight over who's going to get this case or who's going to work that case or, you know, I'm going to work a bazillion cases and be the best damn group in the state of Florida so I can be on TV. You know what I've got to say to those people? Fuck off, okay? Ooh, am I allowed to say that on your radio show? Sorry.
sure.
Sorry. Okay. Fog off. I'll be like the British lady on your show. Fog off. Okay.
Fog off.
But you know what I mean? I, you know,
uh-huh. We've got it set for me.
But they're not contributing in some way, shape, or form to the field. But, you know, it's not about getting on TV. It's not about making money. It's not about any of those ridiculously tangible things that are going to be gone in 5 minutes. You know, don't get me wrong. I'm proud as hell of our group for, you know, getting the show on the Discovery Channel and all the, it's still the number one rated show or episode on a haunting. And, you know, that comes from the people that watch it, not from us, you know, going in and clicking a button every day, you know. And the time I sat and watched that show, and I, poor Frank, I cut off the circulation in the man's thigh because I was digging into his thigh so hard, you know, but that's not why I got in this field. And I don't sit here and think about it every 5 minutes going, I was on the Discovery Channel. You know, that's not what this is about. It's about helping people. It's about learning. It's about teaching others. And it's about being a part of a community. You know, in the pagan community, they used to have a saying, trying to get a bunch of pagans together is like herding cats, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the same thing in this community, you know.
But, you know, Dusty, one of the things that Doug and I kind of kicked around the other day was the concept that, say, for instance, at some point down the road, we do formulate a paranormal review group. And what we do is, that part of the duties of that paranormal review group would be to review evidence in a nonpartisan way that any group wants to submit to that board, and so we can kind of cross-verify it. And I thought that was a great idea, and I'm sure you agree, because there's a lot of groups that, you know, have some – clearly are not as adept in their
analysis, correct, yeah. I guess we lost Grant again.
Yeah, a little bit.
Okay.
See if he comes back.
I finished this sentence for him, though.
That's good.
I can hear you guys. You can't hear me?
Oh,
you dropped out for a second. Right,
well,
at analysis.
Yeah, she finished her sentence for you. And let me
good.
Think a little bit further. That's exactly the standards, the field standards. That's exactly what Paranexus is attempting to do. And I'm not intentionally trying to just blow the trumpet here, but I'm proud of it because, you know, Yari and I, it's our intention, along with Grant, who's the assistant director of it, you know, to have it emerge as something that is going to help us as a community to decide on typical and standards, you know, things that are ethical and do no harm and all that sort of thing. So let's move on from that. So not long after you got started, you were faced with a very interesting case.
That's an understatement.
And, of course, I'm talking about the Dunham case.
the Dunham case, the one that we are, I guess, famous for. The Dunham case, I had received an email. The group had been together for about 3 years, and we were still, and I very admittedly, you know, say this, we were still very green at that point. I received an email from Ed Dunham telling me about some rather interesting activity going on in his home. And we decided to go and, you know, help this family out. And, you know, like the back of my book basically says, what started out as, you know, very mild haunting, within 8 months' time, we actually videotaped a couple's infant daughter being attacked in her crib by one of the entities one night. And the interesting aspect of this particular case is the fact that, you know, there's the four basic kinds of hauntings. You've got residual, intelligent, poltergeist, and demonic, which, you know, demonic hauntings are very rare. The statistics on them are 1 in 360,000 or something like that. So I kind of get a giggle out of, you know, all these people and groups and TV shows that, you know, always have demons following them around and things. But
yeah.
And then, of course, poltergeist activity. And the unique thing about the Dunham case was that we had all four different types of hauntings occurring simultaneously in the home at the same time. So, you know, I'd have two team members sitting in the back bedroom, you know, documenting a cold spot with EMF fluctuations and picking up EVPs, while two other members were in the garage listening to this bizarre banging noise that occurred frequently in the home, while, you know, we were listening to the what we called the horse running across the roof sound, you know, and then two other investigators would be in the baby's room where the temperature level would jump 30 to 50 degrees, and, you know, we'd have these bizarre fecal smells or sulfur smells or...
The temperature would drop, right?
Yeah, no.
Go up high?
It's hot, yeah, oh, wow. Very hot.
And that was in the baby's room, Dusty?
Yeah. The activity in the house was from the what we called the demonic entity, because I don't like putting that tag on anything. And the reason I say that is, you know, if you're in a client's home and you discover that you are facing a non-human demonic-type entity...
Like a malevolent inhuman spirit.
I'm sorry?
Like a malevolent inhuman spirit.
Exactly. You know, if you say to the client, you have an evil demon in your house, that automatically sets up a psychological, you know, process in their brain. If you say to them, you have a negative entity in your home, you know, you're still telling them, look, there's something bad here, but you're not going to upset them as much. Do you get what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
And they're not going to latch on to the religious aspects of that. Because let's face it, you know, even though 80% of Americans claim to be Christians, 80% of those 80% are not practicing Christians, okay?
Right.
So it's a neither here nor there thing. And whether you're Christian or not, you know, this is just my personal belief, and this does not transcend into my research group. You know, to me, it's kind of like voodoo practitioners.
Mm-hmm.
They do something that's called thought forms. And what they do is they actually create beings out of psychic energy to go and perform certain tasks for them, if you will. And they do this through certain rituals. And it's the same thing, in my opinion, personal opinion, with demons. You know, we've got 3,000 years of history of a book that's been taught to literally, you know, billions of people over this 3,000-year time period, saying that these, you know, evil beings are here on Earth with us to do certain things to us. Well, you take the thought of this from these people and you keep it going for, you know, these 3,000 years, and you're actually going to create these beings here on our plane.
Right, like, you know, a mass hysteria or mass
exactly, very similar
type of thing.
Exactly. Whereas, and this is one that a lot of researchers get confused on because of the similarities, is there's actually a fifth kind of haunting that a lot of people don't talk about, they don't know about, and they're actually elementals. Elementals, you know, take care of the elements, earth, air, fire, water. You know, and a lot of the times we've found on a case that, you know, there was no activity in the home for, you know, 20, 25, 30, 35 years. All of a sudden, you know, a hurricane comes through and knocks over this, you know, rare yew tree or something, or, you know, a rowan, or, you know, some tree that's sacred to Native Americans or something, and now all of a sudden there's paranormal activity in the home, you know, and when we find this out, we kind of look at it and go, we might be dealing with an elemental, you know, because they do mimic a lot of the same characteristics as what is traditionally known as a demon would.
Right.
They do a lot of the heat aspects, sulfur smells, fecal smells.
We kind of classify them right along with malevolent inhuman spirits.
Right, exactly.
Or inhuman spirits anyway.
Exactly. They fall into that same category. But with the Dunham case, you know, like I said, we were very green back then, and I thoroughly admit that. You know, and I did reach out into the community. Troy Taylor was very honest with me. He told me, you know, look, Dusty, I've never worked a case like this before, and I honestly don't know how to help you except to send you to Kelly Weaver, who's a touch medium in Pennsylvania. And she actually wound up being a very, very huge help to us. And then I called Dave Giuliano and spoke to him about it and, you know, told him some of our findings. And, you know, he helped us classify some of the stuff that was going on. You know, and unfortunately, the best we could do was counsel the family. You know, they were renting the home. They were very low income. They had two kids from a previous marriage, plus Emily, who was 18 months old at the time, and then another baby on the way. I mean, they were very strapped for cash, you know, and people always say, why didn't they just move out? Hello? You know,
it makes money.
Husband, when, you know, it just doesn't work sometimes, you know? So anyhow, we even at one point almost actually started collecting a fund for them to help them out, find a place to live, you know, all of that. But that's when things escalated, and they wound up leaving the house. The thing that the Discovery Channel did not show was that the baby was physically attacked. And, you know, I understand New Dominion Pictures' reasoning behind not showing that. They didn't want to make Dunham's look irresponsible parents. Mm-hmm. But once I told them, you know, that we had this attack on videotape, you know, they were out of that place in 5 minutes flat, you know. So they know they were not irresponsible parents in any way, shape, or form.
Hey, I'm back, guys. And, you know, Dusty, when one of the most frightening parts of that book for me personally, or that I won't say frightening, unsettling, was the contact that entity had with that little baby, how that went on for the longest period of time. And if you've already done so, can you just digress? And how long was the actual time frame when the investigation started and when it concluded?
We investigated the case for 8 solid months, and about 3 months into it, we literally were there 5 to 7 nights a week, and there were nights where we slept all night. You know, we'd get up at 6 a.m, drive home, go to our day job, get off, you know, come home, check mail, feed the dogs, and go right back to it. I mean, it was that bad. And it wasn't so much towards the end that we were trying to document anything more as we were trying to help keep the family together. Because when we first met the Dunhams, you know, they were a very loving couple. I mean, they were sitting on the couch together. You know, she had her legs slung up over his. He had his arm around her. It was, you know, all baby this and sweetie that. And, you know, and 4 months into this, they're sitting on opposite sides of the room. They're not sleeping in the same bed together. You know, they literally were falling apart. And, you know, we were watching this happen on a daily basis, and it just got to the point of, you know, what do you do? How do you help these people when they're in a situation like that? You know, so we did as much as we could as far as, you know, emotional and physical and psychological support went. But Ed started drinking heavily. Beth started, you know, smoking a little bit, and she was also had the pregnancy she was worried about. I mean, so it was, the whole situation was just a nightmare. It really was. And even though I tried to convey a lot of the emotions and feelings and things that we went through and that they went through in the book, you know, I don't think I did the case justice. You know, a lot of people have talked to me after they've read it and said, oh, my God, you know, well, I couldn't sleep for 3 weeks or, you know, this and that. And I keep thinking to myself, you know what, we finished that case in 2002, and I still have nightmares about that place. You know, I still have the white marble chips get thrown at my front door from time to time. The street light across the street still acts up. I mean, as soon as I pull up at home, you know, boom, that sucker goes off. And as soon as I walk into my front door, it comes back on, you know. And I just...
Let me interrupt you right there, Dusty. We're going to take a break. We're at the bottom top of the hour, but we're going to continue this discussion about the Dunham House and the investigation that you did, some of the interesting things. And, folks, if you have not read that book, Dead and the Dread? No, Dread and the Dead filled the Dunham House or home. You know... It's an excellent book, and it's especially good if you are a paranormal researcher, because there's so many things there that you can learn from it and identify with. That's what I was doing. I've read it twice, and I know I'll read it again. And I go through there and I'm thinking, yeah, you know, that's good. And you know,
it's a great book.
Mm-hmm.
Well, thanks, guys. I appreciate that. And
yeah.
You know, one of the things is, you know, some people buy the book and they think, oh, this is going to be a scary story. And then I, you know, like read their reviews on Amazon. I didn't write this book for the general public. I wrote it for paranormal investigators.
Yes.
And, you know, there are groups out there that have bought it and actually make it mandatory reading for their researchers to tell them, look, this is what an extreme case is like from beginning to end.
Mm-hmm. And plus, it was nominated for Paranormal Book of the Year last year, too, right?
Yes, it was, and it came in second. I'm very proud of that.
Yeah, that's good.
Bravo, bravo.
All right, listeners, hang with us, and we'll be back. We'll continue our discussion with Dusty Smith from Daytona Beach Paranormal Research Group. So hang with us. We'll be right back.
To be tamed, but I'd show the ever after many years before the twilight. So young, vibrant, so charmed by life, keeping the vultures at bay. She had everything going for her till the day she met me. Still, you look so innocent, you don't understand. Open doors and mirrors on my desert. Feel the blood burning in my veins. The back of your mind, you know what I'm. Get through. If you only knew that the wolf stood close, ready to take the masterpiece. think, Mama, you disappear. Still, you look so innocent. Another page of my little black book. One-way streets have come and gone, and the lonely alleys don't take long. Stores and booze has got me down on the horse and pushes on this side of town. Street lights out and dusk is here. It's one thing, Mama, you need me. Still, you look so innocent.
Okay, I guess our music
hey,
stopped.
We're back.
Hey, we are. I'm back.
Was,
are you back?
That was abrupt.
Hey, abrupt is good sometimes.
The spontaneous Friday night.
Ah.
That's a good term, spontaneous Friday night. So let's be spontaneous, eh? All right, this is Doug Kelly with Grant Rubin Dust, and we're interviewing Dusty Smith, Daytona Beach Paranormal Research Group. Welcome back, Dusty.
Thank you, Doug.
Nice we're talking, to have you.
Yeah, it is.
Thank
we're talking
you.
About extreme hauntings. Dusty, of course, wrote the book Dread and the Dead Fill the Dunham House, right? House, not home.
Correct.
Good. Excellent book, Extreme Haunting. And let's pick it up. What else? What did you learn the most from that whole eight-month-long episode?
Well, I learned, you know, like I said, we were very green, and pretty much when we started the case, you know, we had very basic equipment with us, and one of the things that I was trained to do or to use is to always keep in your equipment case a bag of flour, black garbage bags, a ball of string, little bells, and emergency candles. And people always look at me like I have five heads when I tell them that. And I'm going to explain the reasonings for this. Okay, when you are dealing with residual hauntings and you want to, I don't want to say prove, because of course we can't prove anything yet, but at least document that you have a residual haunting in a certain area, what's the easiest way or best way to do it? One of the things that we showed at the Dunham House was one of the entities liked to play with one of Emily's toys, and it was this little bee that lit up. And we even took, like, the batteries out and, you know, the whole nine yards, and this thing still did its thing, lit up whole nine yards, okay? And you would hear this thing moving in the back room, and when you go in, it, of course, would just be sitting there. So I put out a black trash bag and sprinkled some flour on top of the trash bag, and, you know, Beth looked at me like, what are you doing to my carpet, you know? And I set the bee into the flour. And then the following morning when we got up, we heard the bee. And every time we would go out there, we'd look at the bee, and the bee didn't look like it moved. Well, after the course of the night had finished, we went out and looked at it, and sure enough, because the angle we were looking at it, we couldn't see, but that damn bee moved, I don't remember how many inches offhand it was.
A few.
Yeah, it was a few inches in that flower over the course of the night, and there was the very definite marks, and it was so hard pressed into the flower that the not just the wheel marks, but the belly of this thing actually scraped through the flower. And I borrowed the bee, and it made a click sound every time the wheel would move.
Mm-hmm.
And I took it home with me and did an experiment and clicked it across my kitchen counter. And again, I don't remember the exact number. I think it was like 190-something or 150-something click to go that distance. And sure enough, it was the exact distance. So
that's good verification, huh?
Exactly. And we've used the garbage bag and flour trick several times to document things like that. I mean, we've gotten footprints in other locations and, you know, things like that. The emergency candles are also good when you're looking for a residual haunting, because if they walk by a certain area, they might blow that candle out as they go by. Same with the string. You want to use really, really thin string, almost like a thick thread, and get little teeny tiny, very light jingle bells, and you know, tie it off in different locations where they've reported activity. And sure enough, when that stuff starts to jingle in, you know that you're going to want to have your video equipment set up on that kind of stuff,
yeah,
too. You know, and it's great, and it's inexpensive. I mean, you know, one of the things I learned on that case is, boy, don't start investing money in equipment, you know, because even though you use it, the ghosts aren't always going to give you what you want, you know.
Right.
We bought everything from, you know, digital cameras and Gauss meters to CO2 detectors and, you know, the whole nine yards, not only to rule out, you know, anything that was man-made in the house, but to, you know, see what was going on. And I tell you what, these particular entities were pretty damn smart, and they stumped me every time.
Okay, so along the lines of this haunting, this extreme haunting, have you had any others after this one?
None as severe as the Dunham case. We've had a couple of others that also involved kids that were, there was one, I can't mention names or anything like that. They were renting an apartment and had very similar things going on. Turned out that there had been a fire in the apartment complex 30 or 40 years prior to this young couple moving in with their baby. And they were experiencing extreme heat fluctuations in the apartment, and found out, sure enough, the apartment they were in was one of the ones that was devastated in the fire. And there was a gentleman that passed away in that particular apartment in the fire. And, you know, here we were dealing with, it wasn't a non-human spirit. We were dealing with a very angry human spirit. Who was, for whatever reason, lashing out at the infant again. And when we got some very bizarre documentation at that particular case, you know, I phoned them the next day, and the Dunhams never saw the videotape of the baby getting attacked in the crib. And a lot of people bitch at me about that because, oh, it never happened. If you're not going to show it publicly, it never happened. Well, you know, my first question is, why do you want to see a baby getting attacked? You know, it's a very unnerving, very disturbing piece of footage. I had one of my researchers here was was with me the first time we viewed that footage, and she doesn't even have kids. And, I mean, she was brought to her knees in tears. I mean, the guilt that you feel when you see this footage is
well, without getting staggering. Morbid, what exactly did the spirit do? I mean, what was it doing?
It came up out of the floor in front of the closet.
Like a shadow?
It was kind of, the easiest way to describe it, it looked like a gray blob. It had no real form or substance to it, but it moved, and it moved very fluidly. And when it first, it would actually spoke to the baby. It called her by her nickname, and the baby responded to it.
That was the most sinister part of all of that, Dusty. That was just, you know, where you laid the groundwork for, I mean, when you kind of showed how that spirit of that entity had been trying to contact that little baby. That was very sinister.
Yeah, and it was. I mean, she had literally shut down as far as being a member of the family. She would communicate with the spirits and this particular entity, but she stopped talking to her mom and dad. She quit eating. I mean, it was a very bad situation as far as the baby was concerned. And when I say this, I don't want anybody to think that went on for 8 months. This is only over the course of a couple of days. But, you know, she shared her toys with them. She could see them. She knew when they were there, you know.
So this blob rose up out of the floor.
It came up out of the floor in front of the closet, and I'm going to try to imitate its voice. It went, "Oh, Emmy," just like that. I mean, totally creepy, not male, not female, totally creepy, okay? And she went, and sat up in the crib and started having a little, you know, baby Edith conversation with this thing. And then she got kind of adamant with it, and she said, "No." And the next thing you know, this thing moves over to the crib, and you see it. It's like up against the crib rails, and the crib just starts slamming up against the wall in the nursery. And she's like holding on to the side of the crib, looking at this thing. I mean, totally, you know, scared to death. And she's screaming at it, "No, stop, no. And then you see this thing come up over the crib rail, and she, like, flops down into the mattress, and this thing is over top of her, and she is just screaming at the top of her lungs for this thing to stop whatever it was doing to her, you know. And at that point, our microphones cut out because she was screaming so loud, you know, and all you could see was this gray blob in the crib. You couldn't even see her anymore, you know. And when I watched the video and spoke with her mom about it, you know, I said, you know, "Did Emily get up 2 days ago and have any marks or cuts or bruises on her?" And she said, "Oh, my God, yeah." She said, "But, you know, Ed had taken them to the park a couple of days ago, and I thought they just got kind of rough on the swings or something." And I thought, "Oh my God, you know, there's no way that I could have ever shown this to an 8-month pregnant woman and expect her to, you know, not go into early labor," you know. Yeah. And even after the brother, James, was born and they were kind of comfortable with viewing the tape, because I did offer to show it to them again, and they both said no. You know, the guilt that they felt already not even seeing the tape was, you know, astronomical. And then if they had to see it, would just compound that, you know. And I agree with them. And technology today, you know, it's a great thing, yes, but, you know, I don't want this poor kid winding up on YouTube somewhere.
Oh,
you know,
yeah.
If we posted this to our website or something, you know, somebody's going to try to snatch it, and you can see her face very clearly, very plainly, and she still is very young and looks exactly the same, except she's a little taller and her hair is a little longer.
All right, let's ask this question. Okay, so this whole thing happened. What do you make of it? Let's go beyond just the family thing. Okay, we've got this malevolent spirit that has attacked her violently. What do you make of that? Why? What was in it for the spirit? What was it trying to get?
I don't know, you know, and one of the weird things that happened after Beth and Emily left the house was this thing was still in the baby's room, and they had cleared everything out of the room except for a few items that were still in the closet, and Ed went in the bedroom to finish packing things up, and when he opened up the door, there was her life preserver and a stuffed animal lamb sitting in the part of the floor right where this thing had come up out of the floor 3 nights earlier. Now, you know, symbolically, that's a little frightening. You know,
What's your take on it?
My first impression was that Emily was like the sacrificial lamb. And there was one spirit in that house, a female spirit, that was very protective of Emily. You know, we had documented a couple of different times where when Emily would get upset, you could hear this female spirit, you know, trying to quiet her, trying to tell her things were okay. And I think maybe she was the one that placed the life preserver there going, you know, basically, you know, a screw you to the other one going, no, the baby's out of here and, you know, she's okay. I mean, that was just my gut reaction when Ed told me about those two things being placed on the floor the way they were. There's a lot of discrepancies and arguments in the field about using Ouija boards and what we let through and what we don't let through and, you know, closing doorways and portals and things like that. But, you know, I mean, I busted my butt trying to find out why this house was as active as it was, you know. And if you read the book, you know, the whole upside down rainbow thing comes into play. But I'm still not thoroughly convinced that that's the totality of it. You know, we did find out partway through the investigation that when they first moved into the house, they had found an Ouija board and were playing with it. And, you know, I don't know if that had something to do with it or not. I know that whatever was in that house, some of it was okay and nice. And, you know, there were a couple of times where we, you know, smelled bread baking and cookies baking and, you know, warm, fuzzy feelings, and there were other times where, you know, I wanted to piss my pants and run all the way back to Daytona without my car.
Well, hey, Dusty, you know, at any time, I mean, other than you kind of talked a little bit about the stones that were thrown at your patio on the lawn, but did any other members of your team feel threatened? And how about the other kids in the house? Did they ever experience anything similar
What
Emily...
Matt, who was Ed's son from a previous marriage, had a couple of experiences in the house that he never even discussed with me. By the time we had gotten to start the investigation, the boys were basically not allowed to come to the house anymore because of what was going on and how Ed and Beth felt about what was going on. But whatever it was unnerved him to the point that he didn't want to come to Dad's house anymore. And it wasn't until we were filming the Discovery Channel show that he finally told me what had happened. And he had his bedroom was at the back of the house. And after he had a couple of experiences in there, seeing an elderly gentleman smoking a cigarette sitting on the end of his bed, or a cigar, rather, sitting on the end of his bed, he decided to move his bedroom out into the Florida room. And he was trying to sleep out there one night and heard the dead bodies being dragged across the floor. Something pinned him to the bed for just a few seconds. He said around 15, 20 seconds. You know, there were a couple of different instances like that, and he just finally said, "Shut! I'm not coming back to this place till you guys, you know, get whatever it is out of here." Alex, to my knowledge, never experienced anything, but he was, even when the boys were coming to the house, he wasn't there as often as Matt was. The other interesting thing was that the neighbors, when they would come over, would experience things, as well as when Beth's family came to visit. And I actually lost one of my researchers working this case. Roz, who I spoke about frequently in the book, had a couple of different things happen to her while we were doing that case. And she finally told me, she said, "Man, I can't handle this anymore." You know, she said, "I'll stick it out till the end. But once this is done," she said, I can't do this kind of work anymore." She said, it's too much. I don't have the stamina, you know, to help these people the way you do." And, you know, and I understood, you know, what she meant, and her heart was in the right place and all. But one of her experiences was, she was in the guest bathroom, and we had set up a candle in the bathroom sink. And while she was using the facilities, the shower curtain literally blew open and smacked her in the face. And when she tried to get up to, you know, untangle herself, you know, it just got worse. And when she finally got free of it, the candle, total Hollywood kind of stuff, just flamed up, and it scared her to death. That was it. She was done. She never went back to the house after that.
All right. Interesting stuff. If you are listening to our program, you're a paranormal researcher, this program's for you. So if you've got questions, feel free to call in. It's really easy. Don't need to be shy or anything. The number is on the screen there, 347-945-7799. You can also join us in chat and ask questions in the chat room. We'd love to hear from you. I mean, you've got to have some questions about this extreme haunting case because, you know, you never know. You might come up against something. What can you do? What steps can you take? And that sort of thing. So, Dusty, in retrospect, what would you have done differently with the Dunham case?
Well,
if anything.
I think I would have been a little more humanistic and not as scientific as I was coming out of the gate. You know, and I know the book doesn't come across that way. At least I don't think so. You know, when I first started the case, it was very, you know, all the T's had to be crossed, all the I's had to be dotted. You know, everything was, you know, documented, and, you know, we sat up all night watching video monitors and this and that, and we kind of pushed the family off to the side. And I think that first, you know, couple of weeks of us and that initial contact should have focused more on what their needs were. You know, that's one thing I've learned. You know, the other thing is, you know, no matter how bad it gets, you know, no matter what happens, you know, we get to go home at night. These people don't, you know, and you guys both know from reading the book that I got my ribs broken on that case.
Yeah, can you talk about that? Because that really wasn't in the book, right? Was it?
Yeah, it was.
For some reason, it just doesn't stick out. I guess it was, now that you mention it. How did that happen?
They threw a set of golf clubs at me.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, it was Christmas Eve, and Ed made some off-the-cuff comment to the ghosts about Merry Christmas or something, I don't know. And next thing I knew, this full set of golf clubs came up off the floor and hit me in my midsection. And, you know, I was at the emergency room a little while later being told, "Yeah, you got 3 broken ribs." I went, "Oh, great."
Oh,
you know,
those hurt too.
Oh, yeah.
I've had that.
They hurt for a long time.
Yeah.
You know, and I don't want to tell people that to discourage them from working cases like this. But, you know, you've got to be prepared for this kind of stuff, mm-hmm. because when you're working an extreme case, you know, you don't know what to expect, and you need to expect the unexpected. You know, the statistics are that there's only been one documented case of a spirit actually causing the death of a human being in United States history, and that's the very famous Bell Witch case. And, you know, we're still not even sure if it was truly the wife that poisoned him or the daughter, or if it was, as they claim, the spirit that was in the house. You know, and being since that case is over 200 years old, you know, we'll never know the truth.
Mm-hmm.
So technically, the only time that people get really injured on cases is when we let our fight or flight instinct
mm-hmm.
play.
Yes.
I've seen it happen. You know, you get scared and you go to run, and next thing you know, you're slamming into a door or something, mm-hmm. you know.
And so you don't run. You know, there's...
Right.
For all intents and purposes, there's nothing to be afraid of, provided, you know, you've got your senses about you. You've got your presence of mind. That's what you're talking about. Be ready, be prepared. Just, you know, take it seriously. There is a question in the chat room.
I was going with this was that, you know, the other thing that, you know, I hope I've learned over the years is to put those kind of fears aside. I mean, there were times during the Dunham case where I literally was very scared, and I don't scare very easy, you know, and I would have to not show that, you know, to the client. You can't let somebody who's already scared think you're scared. They're looking to you for support and to see what to do and, you know, how to resolve the situation. But the one time that really, really unnerved me completely was this mud man that Ed kept seeing. Usually he would see it run across the roof, and the Discovery Channel show actually did a pretty good job of portraying what it looked like in the brief second and a half that they showed it. But Ed described it as being a lot taller than that, and I was taking photos following Ed around one night, and, you know, I never hold my camera up to my eye. I always look in the LCD screen, and right. I happened to be looking at Ed when I snapped a picture, and in the flash, I actually saw this damn thing standing on the other side of him, and it was about 12, maybe 13 feet tall, and it literally looked like it was a man made out of mud, or more like a gorilla made of mud. And it was, I mean, I froze. I just didn't know what to do. And at that moment, you know, I came up with excuses why I had to leave that night. And one of my researchers, Susie, actually had to talk me into going back the next night. She said, you know, you can't leave these people hanging, Dusty, because you got the shit scared out of you. You got to go back, you know, and she was right. And I did, and that was the end of that.
All right, well, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, let's talk about a couple of things. There is a question in the chat room that I want to ask you. The question is, do you use sensitive mediums in your research? We'll answer that when we come back. If you'd like to call in, the number has been posted in the chat room. It's also on your screen there, 347-945-7799. And when we come back, we're going to continue our interview with Dusty Smith of Daytona Beach Paranormal Research Group. Finished talking about this, and she's also got another book out that she wants to discuss, so we'll talk about that too. If you all will hang with us, we'll be back in just a minute.
The West Georgia Paranormal Research Society is composed of individuals with a common goal, the scientific investigation of the paranormal. It is our hope that these investigations will allow those of us in the paranormal community to bring about answers that will benefit us, as well as helping to educate the general public. We approach all investigations and questions with the utmost professionalism and confidentiality required for the situation. If you are experiencing strange occurrences around your home or place of business, such as unexplained noises, smells, or visual phenomenon, these could be possible signs of paranormal activity. If you're interested in finding some answers to these questions, or if you'd like to have our team investigate the activity, visit us at www.wgprs.com for more information. Research, assistance, understanding. We're here to help you.
Welcome back, everybody. This is Doug Kelly, co-host of Paranexus Universe, along with Grant Reuben Dunst.
Hey, everybody. Welcome.
And we're talking with our good friend, Dusty Smith. Welcome back, Dusty.
Thank you, Doug. Thank you, Grant.
Talking about extreme hauntings, talking about lessons learned, and so on and so forth. And one of the things that I want to focus on is you had mentioned if you had to do anything differently, you would have looked a little bit more at the human aspect. Is that correct? Of the client, paid more attention rather than
early on in the case.
Yeah, early on. So, and that's a good point. And so, let me ask you this question from the chat room: do you guys use sensitives in your research?
Yeah, we do. We don't use them like they're a piece of equipment. You know, when we do an initial investigation, you know, we bring all of our gadgets and gizmos and we map the location, do the initial interviews and all of that. And then, you know, which takes 2 to 4 hours or so. And then, once we get home and you know, decide is this paranormal in nature or not, that's when we start doing the historical background on the location. We do backgrounds on the folks that live there, that have lived there, that have died there. And if we start hitting brick walls, because let's face it, every client wants to know who's haunting my house, why they're here, and what do they want. You know, and unfortunately, these three questions we cannot answer. You know, it's just the reality of things. The reason that we use sensitives is to, number one, try to get those answers for our clients. And, you know, it also puts them a lot at ease because a lot of times you find out that, especially in an intelligent haunting situation, that it winds up being a spirit that's lost in a certain area and is drawn to a family because they remind them of their family when they were alive. And we've found that to be about 42 or 43% of the cases turn out to be that way when it's an intelligent haunting, which I want to jump real quick back to what we were talking about with the community and having standards and things.
Sure.
One of my researchers actually developed a database that we've been plugging all of our information into. And, you know, one of these days I would love to take this to, like, a national level and have other groups inputting the same information, because one thing we've discovered over the years by inputting this information is that for whatever reason, paranormal activity seems to occur more often when the moon is either is new or dark and is in a fire or water sign. And you would think that it would be when the moon is full, but that's not what we've found.
Can you explain the water fire thing?
Oh, yeah, zodiac signs, water and fire signs. Water sign is like Scorpio, fire sign would be Leo, you know, and such like that. The moon changes astrological placement every 2.5-ish days. So when you go on and investigate, you know, everybody's got one of those cool little moon things on their, on their website.
Right.
It's not just about that. It's about planetary placements. You know, everybody goes, oh, we're having an X-class solar flare. Well, do you know what that is? Do you know why we check that information? How does it affect your research? You know, you need to know these things. Because that's another thing. When we're having M-class solar flares, activity actually lessens. But when we have X-class solar flares, activity increases.
Hmm.
Which is, I just thought was kind of an interesting thing, and I'd like to see if it's just geographic or if this is something across the board.
That's interesting. Yeah, and that's something that we all should be logging, is the solar flares, geomagnetic activity, moon phase, and there are other things. I mean, that's what we're all looking for. We're looking for connections.
Mm-hmm.
We're looking for things that make sense and trying to understand this. And I want to just to take what you've said so far, especially in the area of the human factor. One of the things that, and I know you do this, you're out to help the client. That's your priority, correct?
Right.
Yeah, that's what the, ours is too. Help the client, help the spirit if possible, gather information. And so let me ask you this, a couple of questions I have. I'd like to get your input on this. Have you noticed or made any connections or in this area that with the, how do I put this, the people who claim to have paranormal activity, do you find that one or more members of their family are psychically sensitive?
Yeah, and it's usually one of the things that we've found is, you know, a lot of people fall back on poltergeist activity being related to a prepubescent teenage girl. Actually, one of the things that we found is it's not just pre and post-pubescent teenage girls, but boys as well,
sure,
and pre- and post-menopausal women and pregnant women.
Mm-hmm.
You got to figure with all the hormonal stuff going on that, yeah, of course this is going to happen. Yeah.
Okay. And that's what we found as well. We have found that
sensitive, right? Somebody that has sensitive capabilities in the home, and we've even gone in a few of our past cases, have gone so far as to test them. And there's a neat little trick that that Troy Taylor came up with years ago, where you put a washer on a string and you hot glue it into the bottom side of a jar, and then you seal the bottom of the jar shut and turn it up on its lid, so that the spring and the washer are hanging down, and you get the person to focus on it and get them to move it back and forth, kind of like a pendulum would. Unfortunately, if you allow somebody to hold the pendulum, then they can, physically alter it by moving it. If you're unable to touch what you're trying to move and you try to do it psychically, that's when you go, oh, okay, this guy's pretty cool,
Mm-hmm.
We don't do that very often because some people get offended, going, what, you don't believe me, and you got to kind of be careful about stuff like that. So, you're right. And one of the things, I know a lot of people think that sensitive capabilities skip generations. We've actually found that that's not true, that it really does run in families and does not skip generations.
Here's a question from Yari.
Yari.
He has got a case coming up in Wyoming. And it's, I'm just going to read his question. He's working on his case in Wyoming that's on Indian land and thought to be by the client, an MIS, malevolent inhuman spirit or malevolent human spirit. That's them, not him.
Mm-hmm.
He says, I'm currently talking to a shaman to come with me, especially since I'm versed with cultures. He wants to know what your experience is in working with Indian nations, if any.
Well, yes. We have had experience working with the traditional Seminole tribe here, which actually we worked with them during the Dunham case. And I have a couple of friends here that are Native American that have helped us out on a couple of recent cases. My experiences with them are very good. You have to be understanding and open-minded to their specific spiritual belief system, because it's
mm-hmm.
generally very different than most Americans.
Mm-hmm.
their beliefs in the spirit realm are very different than the way that most Caucasian, at least, Americans are raised. We're raised to believe that you die and you go to heaven and that's it. Native Americans are not raised that way. When a spirit passes over, crosses over, it's to another sphere of consciousness, and they're almost in several different tribal traditions are able to flip back and forth through doorways and portals to come back to this side to accomplish tasks they didn't finish when they were alive, which I found to be very interesting.
Yes, well, that's good. I also have an affinity for Native American culture, being part Cherokee. I think a lot of people are, but I've got that too. I think Gary is as well. All right, let's keep going. In over your 13 years as a paranormal investigator, we're down to about 10, 12 minutes left in the show. What advice would you give to those who are just starting out or who have been doing it and, not as long as you? Anything come to mind?
The first thing that comes to my mind is, educate. There are no traditional courses or classes or anything like that out there that teaches you this field. You know, your course, the course through the American Ghost Society and the one through Flamel College, are all great ways to, you know, either get your feet wet or, you know, broaden what you've already got, your course especially for the latter, you know, and then network. You know, this is a great community full of very intelligent people that, you know, are all of like mind. I mean, for the most part, it, like in any community, you're going to have a small percentage that are in it for the wrong reasons. But for the most part, you know, we've got a great community full of wonderful people that are very intelligent, that are in this to, you know, not only help the clients and to help the spirits on occasions when the need arises, but also to get in touch, I think, with their spiritual sides themselves. You know, a lot of people get into this field and they're very unsure of a lot of things about life and death and the universe. And after they've been in it for a while, they start to have very more solid perceptions of that as far as how it applies to themselves and their lives and their existence and their place in the universe. And I think that's kind of a bonus as far as the field is concerned. You know, I don't think people should get into this field, you know, if they're looking for, you know, their 5 minutes of fame or their, you know, $1 million TV contract or anything like that, because that's not what this is about. The bottom line is it's about helping people and, you know, hopefully someday, you know, being taken seriously enough in mainstream science community that, you know, we'll be able to prove something.
Right.
You know, the powers that be in the universe at this point still don't want us to know everything that's going on. And that's not just with, you know, ghosts and spirits. It's with a lot of different things, you know, as far as cryptozoology or ufology goes, you know. And I'm cool with that for right now. But, you know, of course, when I die, Doug, I'm coming back and answer to a few things.
Yeah, let me know, did you? Yeah, contact
Make
me.
Make it easy.
And, you know, and what you're saying is exactly right. We, as a community, need to take it up a notch. If you're a paranormal researcher out there, take that advice that Dusty just gave. Really think it through. Why are you doing this? What do you want out of the deal? If you're a thrill seeker, well, that's one thing, but that's not the kind of serious research that at least I'm interested in. I know you're interested in, Dusty,
right,
and Grant and all of us. You know, what we're trying to do is really step into the new century. We don't want to do paranormal research with one foot stuck in the past or with one foot stuck in the old school. We've got to rethink things. We've got to have fresh thinking. We need to explore different avenues. We need to bridge that gap with the parapsychologists, you know.
We
really need to make a name. You know, paranormal researchers, the serious ones, they are real. They are professional people. They are smart people, intelligent people, like you said. And so for our listeners, be one of them. Take this seriously. It's a passion. It's a calling for many of us, but not for everybody. And if it's just a hobby, well, that's one thing. But if you have a calling, take advantage of that. Educate yourself, like Dusty says.
You know, if you're a thrill seeker, go bungee jumping.
Yeah.
You know, go climb K2. Go whitewater rafting or something. Don't put clients in a position to where they can be endangered by you being selfish and wanting to, you know, for whatever reason, you know, have a thrill, making a name for yourself or, you know, whatever, because that's not it. The client has to come first, and sometimes the client is not a living human being. Sometimes the client is of another realm. you know. So,
you know, the important thing is too, guys, is that I think a lot of newer groups who don't particularly use the same approach as our groups do, they lose sight of the fact that even in traditional academic circles, everybody puts their work out on the table for everybody to self-review. And I think rather than having a competitive viewpoint, or there's nothing wrong with being competitive, but by the same token, if we're ever going to get anywhere in this field, we need to share and cross-reference information and use those data banks like you've got, Dusty, to cross-reference. And, you know, if we get a significant or paranormally significant situation or an investigation, then let another group go out and independently try to replicate or at least get the same data that we got before. So I would encourage, and I'm sure you guys agree with me, all groups to work cooperatively with other groups in your community.
Yes.
Well put. Very well put, Grant. Yeah, because, you know, it's not about, you know, I run into, I mean, of course we've got some clients that we have to keep confidential because of their requests.
Mm-hmm.
And we're fine with that. But we have a larger percentage of clients that, you know, are fine with us sharing their information. And you don't have to disclose people's, you know, personal names, addresses, phone numbers, things like that. You can talk about the evidence and the documentation without including, you know, the client's personal information. And, you know, that's a huge part of it is, you know, if, you know, 10 years ago when we were working the Dunham case, you know, if we could have had, because at that time there were no other research groups in the state. Let me take that back. There was one other research group in the state, you know, and, you know, here we are reaching out halfway across the country for help, you know, and if we would have had another group that came in and we go, look, you know, this is going on, are we going nuts, you know, you know, and they could go in and document the same thing that we were experiencing, I think about how phenomenal that would have been. I mean, we kind of joked around after the case was over that wouldn't it be kind of neat if the house ever came up for sale or, you know, for rent again for us to get it as a kind of research laboratory to work out of and train other researchers on how to work those types of cases, you know, which of course never happened. But, you know, you're right. I mean, I would have loved to have had someone backing us up and going, yeah, you know, we're getting the same kind of EVPs and voice overlaps and sound manipulation and,
yeah,
you know, mud men running across the roof and everything else, you know. So, yeah, it would be great if we can finally achieve that.
And that just underscores what you had said earlier about networking. I mean, you and I have networked. I mean, that's why we know each other. And go to some of these conferences. I mean, Morgan Bell was just on our program from Southwest Florida Paranormal Research, and they're having a thing for strictly for paranormal researchers in Florida, in St. Petersburg. I think it's in June. Just look up Southwest Florida Paranormal Research. And, you know, there's others going on as well. Of course, we've got Paranexus happening here in October in Tampa. And, you know, it's for that reason, to get people together. And so if you're a group out there, get to know some of the other people in the field and
exactly.
Call them. And if they have an attitude, that's taught you something. Okay, these people are not on the same vibrational level, if you will. They are not in it for the same reason. So then keep looking, because those of us who are in this and who are serious about this are more than happy to lend a hand, to share, to give some advice.
Exactly.
And so I keep saying this, you know, we're not competitors, folks. We are colleagues. There is zero competition. I mean, if one of my members says, gee, Doug, I'd like to start my own group, I'd say, cool, how can I help? Because
there
it's not
are.
A competition. There is no competition, and unfortunately, some of the newer groups or the ghost hunter groups think it's a competition. It's not. We're all in this together. We're all trying to understand the human condition. So,
and while you're on the subject of lectures, if you don't mind me
go ahead.
This in real quick.
Yeah, get your plugs in real quick. We've got about 2 minutes.
Thank you. Next month, May 8th through the 11th, I'll be up at Patrick Burns Ghost Talk in Savannah, 3-day convention. It's Ghost Talk 6, which is good. You know, some of these conventions don't make it past their first year. And I highly recommend Patrick's conference. A lot of great people up there. I met Joey Ward, Don Graham.
He's going to be on our show next week, by the way.
There you go. And Joey's a sweetie. You met him in Casadega. Fabulous guy.
Yeah.
June, I'm going to be up at Troy Taylor's American Ghost Society's conference. July, I'm going to be at TAPSCon in Clearwater. I think I have August off. I'm not sure. September, I'm going to be up in St. Augustine again at Ghost Augustine. And then October, I'll be doing the Paranexus conference. And then Steve still hasn't decided on a date for his next conference down here, but I'm sure it's going to be in February sometime.
Okay, real quick, where can people get your books at?
Oh, okay. Well, they can...
Your main website?
...me on eBay under seller D as in David, B as in boy, P as in Paul, R as in Roger, G as in George. Or they can get Dread and the Dead Filled the Dunham House on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, or through my publisher, which is Publish America. And my new book, which is... Haunted Daytona Beach, a ghostly tour of the world's most famous beach, is through the History Press and can also be found on Barnes & Noble and Amazon and all of those.
Good, and we'll put a link on Paranexus as well. So
people, and if they get them from me, I'll autograph them for you.
And you, if you go to one of the conferences where she's at, then...
Yeah, I'll have them there as well. Correct.
Dusty, we're really running out of time here. It's been such a pleasure. Thank you so much for being on our program with us.
I'm glad you asked me to be on.
Yeah.
Hey, you're a lovely lady, Dusty, and it's always nice talking to you.
Thank you, Grant. I can't wait to see you again.
Okay.
And vice versa.
And our listeners, again, thank you so much for tuning in. Next week, we've got Joey Ward from West Georgia Paranormal Research Society. He's also the host of Beyond the Boundaries Radio. So tune in with us next week. Again, go to paranexus.org, become a member, join us in this venture. And if you want to get some education, you can also check out the CPI course there. And with that, we're out of time, folks. Have a great night. Good night.
Blog Talk Radio.